Welcome once again to our program called The Universal Call to Holiness, or the call of all in any state of life to be a person who is holy, whole, wholesome, and of course happy. That's the road to happiness, or trying to follow the example of Jesus, who is the Holy One, God made flesh among us. We've been talking for several programs now about what is wholeness, holiness, what is following Jesus. We've been talking recently about prayer, the means of the spiritual life. We've talked about the great spiritual writers talk about we go from first base, second base, third base to finally get to home to the beatific vision. And first base, by many of the spiritual writers, is called the purgative way. Second base is called the illuminative way, and third base is called the unitive way. And these are ways that we advance closer and closer to God by our own efforts, but particularly by God's grace and light and healing. So my guest once again is Ron Eldred, who's professor of religion and church history, or world history, excuse me, and they both are kind of combined in the John Paul II program. And I'm your host, John Paul II, and I'm your host of Father Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick's at Ninth Catholic Church at 19th and Poplar. Ron, welcome once again. We were just finishing up the last program on contemplative prayer, or the unitive way, that are sort of hand in glove with each other. And we were just going to talk about what are the benefits of getting to third base before we get home to heaven in our prayer and our unitive wanting to do the will of God first and foremost of all things.
Let me preface that with a few comments, which will correlate with the comments you just made about the different ways of holiness as we become more holy. The purgative way, they usually correlate verbal prayer with that. That a person at this stage of holiness, when they're trying to turn their life around and get rid of a lot of bad habits and start to develop good habits and things of that sort, that they tend to practice verbal prayers, whether they be formulative prayers that have been written by somebody else or in our own words, it doesn't matter. As long as we make these prayers our own, they make them our own thoughts, we incorporate them into our own thinking. And then when we get to the illuminative way, the spiritual writers usually correlate this with a meditative prayer. And meditative prayer basically involves thinking about truths that we find in the scriptures or different events during the time of the life of Christ. Or it could be an Old Testament. It could be anything where we're
slowly reading through the scriptures. Yes. Could be a form of meditative
prayer.
Yes,
we spent quite a bit of time explaining Lectio Divina, that is praying over the scriptures. And then when a person gets into the unity way, which probably very few people in this life reach, but that's a very, very close union with God. And people in that stage usually would practice what's called contemplative prayer. And contemplative prayer is something that comes from God's side of the curtain that separates us from Him. It's something that we can't force, we can't make it happen. But on the other hand, it's something that we can prepare ourselves by leading holy lives for. And some of the people who have become saints, and I'm talking about the saints that have been canonized, there have been millions of people who have become saints, of course, that haven't been canonized, by far the great majority. But there have been a few people, because such as St. Teresa of Avila or St. John of the Cross, or many hundreds of others, people of that sort have achieved a very, very close union with God in this life. And these people have experienced all kinds of what we call mystical, extraordinary mystical experiences, such as levitation, or a heavenly perfume is called the odor of sanctity, or the ability to levitate, or to go into ecstasy, or to have apparitions, or that is visions, or locutions, that is, you know, hearing voices of Christ speaking to them, or, you know, some saint, or the Blessed Mother, or whatever. Now, to get to the question here, what are some of the benefits that a person experiences who has what we might call ordinary mystical experiences, a person who achieves a very close union with God in this life.
Kind of like Catherine of Siena in her dialogues with Jesus, or Teresa of Avila.
Or St. Therese of Lisieux. I have a list here that we already looked at when we were looking at the different ways that we just mentioned a while ago. But we'll go through them again because it's so important to our purpose here. And if you might recall, I got these ideas from Father Thomas Dubay, who wrote a book called The Fire Within. And he also has several series of programs on EWTN television. One of them, if I recall right, was on St. Teresa of Avila, where he was explaining her spiritual writings, and another was St. John of the Cross. And he's one of the world's most renowned spiritual directors and, a very holy man himself.
Repeat the name of the book, Fire Within.
Fire Within.
Is that something that would be a good place for people to begin?
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't consider it necessarily advisable to try to jump into St. John of the Cross. Even St. Teresa of Avila can be difficult. Now, she writes very simple, very, very simple. Not like John of the Cross. He flies, he's soaring. She writes very, very practically, very down to earth. The problem is with her writings is that she wasn't organized. She wasn't systematic. She would write, and then she might set it aside for a while, and then she'd come back again and start writing again, and just no telling exactly where she might pick up. And she was writing under obedience anyway.
Under a very busy schedule.
Oh, yes. And she really didn't really want to do this. But nonetheless, she was doing under obedience of her spiritual director and maybe even the local bishop. I'm not sure now. I've forgotten that detail. But a book by Father Dubay, and he's written a couple of other books on how to pray. And where he has one book particularly, and I don't recall the name of the book. It's been quite a while since I've read it, where he gives some very, very practical advice on how to pray. But Fire Within is a book where he tells us, St. Teresa's, he goes through her seven mansions as you get holier and holier, or he goes through the ascent of Mount Carmel, which of course is the analogy used by St. John of the Cross, as one climbs these mountains, so to speak, and becomes holier and holier. Well, nonetheless, Father Dubay lists in his book probably a good 20, if I recall right, benefits of contemplative prayer, something that comes from God, from God's side of the curtain. And I picked out some of the ones, I think about maybe 10 of them here. Peace and refreshment of mind and soul. Another is heroic virtue, which is the ability to practice virtue in an extraordinary way. When a saint, when they're examining the lives, of a person for sainthood, that's what they look for more than anything else, is see if they lived a life of heroic virtue. In other words, did they live in a very extraordinary way the virtues of faith and hope and charity, of prudence and justice and temperance and fortitude and all the many, many virtues that flow from these cardinal virtues. And I've seen the list as high as 75 of these virtues. at various places.
So it's a heroic living of these great virtues theologically.
Far beyond, I won't say the call of duty, because that's the whole purpose of this series of programs, is the universal call to holiness that, Jesus said, be perfect as is our Heavenly Father. And he wouldn't have asked us to do these kind of things if it were impossible. Now, of course, obviously it isn't possible on our own efforts. It's only possible, of course, with God's grace and with God's help.
Of course, and isn't Therese of Lisieux considered to be an extraordinary living of the ordinary requirements of the Carmelite life? So much that when she died, her friends or her compatriot sisters said, well, she certainly never did anything extraordinary.
Well, the whole idea of her theology, and that's why she was made a doctor of the church by John Paul II back in, I think, the late 80s, if I recall right. I don't recall exactly the date, but nonetheless, her idea of the little flower, she wasn't like Big Teresa, Teresa of Avila, who was also a Carmelite, of course. She, I'm just little. I'm small. I can't.
I'm a child.
I'm a child. I'm not. I'm not going to have that kind of fame. You know, I don't want that kind of fame, and I'm not going to have that kind of fame. I'm just little. And so she came up with this idea of just doing little things in your day-to-day life.
With an extraordinary love
yes.
of God.
In other words, ordinary things for the extraordinary love of God. And, of course, the church, from the time of her death and what have you, have seen that this whole idea was had a lot for the lay people,
ordinary
particularly
person.
The ordinary people. And so that's one of the reasons that she was made a doctor of the church, because of the wisdom of the advice that she had, probably inspired advice that she had.
And it might be helpful to say there's a distinction in her approach between being childish and childlike.
Oh, yes, yes.
She took Jesus saying, unless you become like little children, dependent upon their parents, and we are realize our dependence, a complete and total dependence on God, that's what it means to be a child, childlike, not childish.
Well, and she sure grew up very fast, because she became a nun when she was 15. She had gotten special permission from Pope Leo XIII, if I recall right, for that. And but he still left it up to the local bishop whether or not, you know, when she could be accepted. And I think, if I recall right, she was accepted into the local Carmelite monastery there when she was only 15. She already had, if I recall right, three sisters there in that particular, at least two at that time, in that particular monastery.
In Lisieux.
In Lisieux.
Mm-hmm. A person, if I would do my duties of my state of life, which is a great requirement, married person, single person, religious, priest, widow, widower, high school student, with an extraordinary love of God, then I'm on the high road to holiness.
Well, she was only 24 when she died, and she was obviously a very mature woman. In fact, if I recall right, from the time she was maybe 20 or 21, she was given the job of being in charge of the novices, and you know, and preparing the new girls coming into the convent there for, you know, a life of a nun, a Carmelite nun.
And we're talking about the big trees of Avila and the little trees of Lisieux. We might give a plug for our Carmelite monastery, which has been there for over 50 years. They're still following in the sandaled footsteps of Teresa of Avila and Teresa of Lisieux. And if anybody has any inclination to think about the Carmelite order, please think and pray about it and contact the sisters. They'll tell you anything you want to know.
Another thing that Father DeBay lists here is the innocence of evil. One thing I've noticed about people who are extraordinarily holy, you don't run across very many people like that, but when you do, one thing I've seen, they have a tendency not to recognize evil in other people. They always see good in people when there's not as much good as another observer might see.
So they even see the good that's in the person, or possibly in the person, and so they hate the sin, but they love the sinner.
Yes, I think that innocence of evil means more than just that, but I think that's a major aspect of it. A cessation of inner suffering, a cessation of imperfections. In other words, a person up to that point in their life, and as they try to climb the mountain of holiness, the Mount Carmel, they become more and more perfect. They rid themselves more and more of imperfections, of course, obviously, with the help of God's grace. But I think there's a point, maybe, when a person gets to be holy enough, then God gives them a tremendous big boost, and more help than he ordinarily would, let's say, for them to be a perfect.
I believe John of the Cross says, in the unitive way, that as iron in the fire eventually becomes fire, that a person who's really close to God then eventually becomes God-like or Jesus-like.
Well, I can see that this is why Father DeBay used the title, The Fire Within, that this fire within has to be It all starts with baptism, of course. Then it has to be stroked and, fed. Throughout a whole lifetime, of course.
Nourished, given fuel.
Yes, given
and,
fuel.
That especially comes from prayer.
Another is remarkable delight in God's creation. We see this particularly with the great saint, St. Francis of Assisi, and St. John of the Cross. You read where he would, in the monastery, he would look out the window at night and just admire the heavenly bodies, the stars and the planets, you know, that he could see. And I think he wrote about those kind of things.
O Lord, how wonderful is your name in all the earth. You have proclaimed your glory upon the heavens, from the psalmist. Well, and of course, Jesus quoted so often from nature itself, birds of the air, the lilies of the field, all the visible things of creation. Jesus obviously was a person who was very much attuned to the wonders in God's creation.
Well, of course, the perfections of nature, the beauty of nature, reflects in some way God's perfections. And so a person who's a really, really holy actually would be much more acutely aware of that. And we also know, and we're preparing a series of programs on apologetics, and one of the questions we'll be dealing with there is, how do we know that God exists? How can we prove that? And one of the things the church has always taught is that we can look at God's creation and reason from that to his existence, and that includes, of course, his perfections, because that's how we come up with some of the ideas about his attributes, some of his perfections.
His beauty, his his wisdom,
his justice,
truth,
all these kinds of things.
It's I've always liked the quotation that there are two books from which we easily learn about God and his will for us and his attributes, as you say, his wisdom and his goodness. The book of Revelation, which is the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the book of nature, which is there for any of us, all of us to read. Paul says, from the visible things of creation, we come to a knowledge of our invisible creator. You know, I think it's in the letter to the Romans. So that's something, you know, particularly in our age that stresses environmental care so much, which is a good stress. Take care of be good stewards of the visible creation God has given us. But that's a book that's open every day for any of us, especially during springtime, when the marvels and the miracle of springtime, the birth of the whole world after the coldness and death of winter.
The next benefit I have here is the constant awareness of God's presence. I think that's one of the most important ones. I think up to that time, a person would have to make a special effort to be aware of God's presence. In other words, a person in the purgative stage, perhaps and probably a person well into the illuminative stage, they would have to be an act of the will, for the most part, for them to be aware that God's present. That God is dwelling in their soul, the indwelling Trinity, or God's present in other ways, or whatever. But on the other hand, when a person gets to that contemplative level, then God himself makes the person aware of his presence, more and more so.
Sort of like a fish surrounded by the water. I don't know whether fishes know about the water, but I think a person who has achieved this a unitive way sort of realizes, I'm like a fish surrounded by the omnipotence of God in whom I live and move and have my being, as the Acts of the Apostles talks about. We're just sort of in contact, if a person is in contact, because they're at third base. They've climbed that high. So it's these are wonderful benefits.
Another is all actions are performed for God. In other words, the more holy a person becomes, the more like Jesus a person becomes, the more of what they do is done consciously, I think, for the glory of God and for the benefit of their neighbor.
They tell that story about Mother Teresa, one of Mother Teresa's sisters, Missionaries of Charity, and that a reporter interviewing her from the United States saw her taking care of one of these decomposed human bodies that were still alive and bringing it into the house for the dying and taking care of the person's infected and worm-filled wounds. And the reporter, a woman reporter, said to her sister, I don't think I would do that for $1 million. And the sister answered, and neither would I. She was doing it for the, obviously, the glory and the love of God.
And the last one I have here, as I said, although Father DeBay does list others, is fullness of joy. And joy is more than just happiness. Joy is a happiness that has the added dimension, of course, of God to it.
Jesus said many things about that. I have come that you might have life, have it to the full. I've told you these things, I reveal these things to you, that my joy may be yours and your joy may be complete. So joy is I'm trying to think of the right words as a quotation. Well, Abbot Marmion, the great spiritual writer who's up for canonization, he called joy the echo of God's life in our soul. It's something that resounds like music in the hallways. It's something that comes from being close to God.
Well, there are some of these are some of the main benefits of contemplative prayer that can be achieved by those who become holy during their lifetimes. And the main thing to remember, though, I think, is that these gifts are purely gifts from God. We do not deserve them, but we can cooperate with God's grace to receive them, and we're all called to do this. God offers each of us the grace to lead holy lives. However, we have to use our will to make the decision to accept this grace. I think we can prepare for the infusion of God's grace by emptying ourselves of vices and sin.
So that's always, we have to get, if we're full of imperfection, sin, selfishness, self-centeredness, we've got to empty that cup in order that God's goodness and the virtues and faith, hope, and love can grow within us. I liked your emphasis there that these are gifts from God, but we have to partake of them. If I have food on the table and don't eat it, I'm making a decision to starve myself, or if there's medicine on the table and I don't take it from the doctor, I'm making a decision not to use the healing medicine that the doctor gave me. Or if we don't accept God's gifts, obviously we're going to starve spiritually, or we're going to deteriorate spiritually. Okay, here's a real important question. And we'll only get into it briefly, but why doesn't God always answer my prayers is a common question.
Well, sometimes it seems that he doesn't, he always does. He always listens to our prayers, and he always answers them in some way. I guess the thing is, we just simply have to learn to listen for the answer. For he speaks to us, I think, in a lot of different ways. Among the ways that he speaks to
us. Now, excuse me, go through those slowly, because I think sometimes we forget that God speaks to us in a lot of ways.
Oh, yes.
And we have to be alert.
It usually isn't a voice.
Right.
Maybe a mystical experience, an extraordinary mystical experience of somebody who's very holy might get that.
But Paul on the road to Damascus,
yes,
heard Jesus. But here's other normal ways that God speaks to us.
Well, Holy Scripture, certainly.
And, especially.
As we talked about Lectio Divina, there's a fourth step we listen. And I think writings of the Church Fathers.
Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, all the great.
33 of them in total. The lives and writings of the saints, sermons, history. I teach history and study history, and there are lots of times that the person can read something that you feel like you're getting some kind of an answer to some prayers. The book of nature, as we kind of referred to a while ago, just by looking, have an appreciation, a love of nature.
Let me go back just a moment. Isn't there a famous saying that if we, and I don't remember who said it, but if we do not learn from history, we are destined to
repeat ourselves.
Repeat the past.
Yeah, that was Santayana. Was it? I believe it made that statement.
And reading church history, obviously we can learn to avoid a lot of mistakes.
Santayana was a Spanish philosopher, I think, if I recall right. Thomas Carlyle also made a comment, a British historian of the 19th century, that what we learn from history is that we don't learn.
Well, that's very good. I like that. Thomas Carlyle said that?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was something of that sort.
Sure.
Theologians would be another, the writings of theologians, the writings of spiritual directors. We've been looking at Thomas DeBay, for example, here today. We'll be looking at Jordan Almond pretty soon here in some of our sessions we're getting ready to have, one of the world's greatest spiritual directors. Confessors, literary writers, sacred music, sacred art, especially sacred art. It could be any art, but especially sacred art. Teachers, parents, friends, relatives, and others. These are all different ways that God could speak to us in some way or another.
And I would just like to emphasize that we often forget that our, especially as we're growing up, that our parents speak God's words to us from their wisdom. And we notice that parents marvelously are always older than their children, and the reason is because they're supposed to instruct their children from the experience and knowledge and faith that they've already lived themselves. Okay, so many ways to hear God speaking to us.
Well, I think like any loving father, God wants to give his children good things, and he has the power to do so. He can do this because he's all-knowing, and he knows what we need, and he is all-powerful so that he can give us anything and that he desires. And because he's all-knowing and he's all-powerful, God has already accounted for all of our prayers from the very beginning of time. I remember the first time that struck me when I read that. I don't recall which theologian or whoever I was reading, but I think it was, quite frankly, years ago when I was reading Father John Harden's Catechism. I said, well, that's really something, you know. In other words, God, you know, he knew from the very beginning we were going to be here. He knew everything we were going to ask. He knows everything. He's so all-knowing. He's so all-powerful. He can do anything. He already worked that into the whole scheme of things, into his divine providence, that prayer, how he was going to answer that prayer for us. In other words, he knew what we were going to ask for from the beginning and what we would need, and because he lives in the eternal present, he has no beginning or end. And he is, as he told Moses in the burning bush, I am who am. And we should have faith and be confident that God will answer all of our prayers. And he does answer our prayers. May not always answer me exactly like we would like, but he knows best what's best for us. And
I think we're going to talk about that in more detail in our next round. But our time is running out. So as we conclude our session again on the universal call to holiness, the call of all persons to faithfully follow the image of Jesus. We'll be with you hopefully next session. May God bless you always and in all ways.